Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me here, MLB.com national editor Matt Myers. We got an interesting show today because we just had the first big trade of the season, Jose Quintana to the Cubs. We're going to talk about that. A couple of hitters who should hopefully be rebounding. Some interesting stuff from the Futures game and a Hall of Fame inductee that we may have talked about once or twice before. But real quick, before we get into this stuff, Matt, you attended all of the All-Star festivities. How did you enjoy it? What stood out to you?
The Home Run Derby was pretty cool.
It's
turned into a fantastic event.
Can I say, and I understand I come at this with an extreme amount of bias, given that we both work for MLB, the changes to the Derby and the All-Star game over the last couple of years, like adding in the timer and making the game itself not count, are phenomenal, right? It's really, I think, improved both events.
The Home Run Derby has gone from being like a little bit of a drag to like now it's like a really fun event. And the players, they're getting the right guys in it.
Absolutely.
This year was like almost everyone you would want to see in it.
Joey Gallo is maybe the only guy, but like you have Judge, you have Stan, you have Sano, you have Sanchez. I mean, these are exactly the guys who should have been.
So it was a fun week.
Yeah.
Marlins Park, I'd been to briefly before. This is the first time I really got to see a game there, so I could check that one off the list.
As I remember, you were there for the World Baseball Classic when you got to go on the air with John Smoltz and explain to him what catch probability was, which we just invented like 3 days beforehand.
This is true. Good memory.
So that was fun. Let's get to, so like 2 hours ago, we had our first big trade. Jose Quintana from the White Sox to the Cubs. And what the first impression I had of this trade was, we all learned about it via press release. There are no rumors whatsoever.
These are the best kinds of trades. The best kinds of trades are the ones where everyone finds out about the whole thing at once from a press release. I'm always impressed when clubs are able to sort of keep it so buttoned up that nothing gets out. Press release came. I was sitting at my desk. I think I said, holy bleep, something that I can't say on the air. And Mike was like, what are you talking about? Because it was just a press release that just said Eloy Jimenez, like trade, like Eloy Jimenez. I was like, wait,
he was the headline?
Because it was the White Sox release that got
first.
Oh,
okay, gotcha. Yeah, and you know, I have to wonder what happened in Miami, right? Were the two front offices there and we're just hanging out in each other's press box suites talking about this? Jose Quintana from the White Sox to the Cubs, and there's a lot to unpack here. One thing I think is interesting is we maybe stop talking about how teams won't trade in between the division or the city anymore, right? Because that's been like a long-held thing. Oh, it won't happen. I know this is like the first major trade in a while, but we're seeing this change now as a new generation of front offices.
Yeah, no, they actually have a good quote from Rick Hahn here. This notion that we wouldn't do business with them because they're in town or somehow we would actually take an inferior baseball deal for non-baseball reasons because of emotion or a rivalry or something totally unrelated to putting the best possible team on the field for the next several years is frankly somewhat laughable.
There's anger in that. Yeah, I actually kind of like that.
That's not how Jerry is wired, Kenny is wired, I'm wired, or anybody in the organization.
I love it. I'm actually extremely in favor of that. All right, so we'll get to...
For the record, it was the first deal between the two teams since 2006. The famous Neil Kotz... someone whose name escapes
me. It doesn't even matter. Before that, I believe John Garland and Matt Karchner. Happen a lot.
And, I mean, amazingly, they did trade Sammy Sosa for George Bell.
And as you reminded me years ago, Ron Santo briefly spent the last few minutes of his career as a White Sox. And if this trend continues, we'll hopefully be seeing Lucas Duda as a Yankee, which should have happened like a month ago. That's a different tangent entirely. So Jose Quintana is a really interesting guy. I mean, he was going to the Cubs, and I don't think, you know, of all the things that have gone wrong for the Cubs this year, one of the least surprising, I think, is that their starting rotation has been kind of thin. I mean, we knew this back in the winter, that it was unreasonable to expect that the same five guys would stay healthy all year long, and after having pitched into November, that they'd be as effective as they were. And that hasn't happened. So that's not a total surprise that they need a starting pitcher. But I think it's interesting because Quintana is one of those guys where sometimes he's hard to value because he's really valuable because of his durability. He throws 200 innings a year. This might be his fifth straight year doing so. And he's valuable because he has pretty good contact skills, but he's not a flamethrower. You know, he's not Max Scherzer. He's not Clayton Kershaw. He's also under contract for an extremely team-friendly deal, under contract through, I believe, 2020, if they want.
Guaranteed through 2018 with club options of 10.5 for 19 and 20. I mean, the first line of the Cubs press release said he's under control through 2020.
Right, right.
So it's pretty clear how they see it. And understandably, $10.5 million a year for a pitcher. I mean, that's like a, you know, 10.5 is what a number four starter gets in free agency these years.
And that's a big deal because, you know, the Cubs, John Lester's under contract for a long time, but Arrieta is almost free agent. John Lackey's going to be a free agent. Hendricks is under team control, but you know, hasn't exactly had a very good or healthy year. And I, as I remember when I wrote last winter that the Cubs should trade Schwarber for a controllable starting pitcher, which looks better by the day, by the way, that, I mean, I'm pretty proud of that one, I have to say. Cubs fans got so mad at me, and it was fantastic. But as I said at the time, and this is probably no longer true, but at the time, they didn't have in their MLB pipeline top 20. I think the first guy they had who was a pitcher above single A was like number 18. Like, it was all low-level pitchers or high-level bats. They just do not have any young pitching, nearly ready young pitching in the system. So the fact that they didn't get a rental, but a guy who's going to be in that rotation for the next couple years with John Lester and hopefully Kyle Hendricks, that's a huge deal for them. And that's a big part of why they had to give up such a huge prospect haul to get a guy like Jose Quintana.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's why Quintana was the most appealing guy on the market. And what's interesting about this trade is because of that contract, he's a player that from a salary standpoint pretty much any team could be in on. And the Brewers were supposedly one of the teams in on Quintana. So in some reason I could see the reason why the Cubs struck quickly is knowing that it was kind of a preemptive strike to get a couple extra starts out of him, but make sure the Brewers couldn't get him. Because the Brewers aren't going to go trade for Cueto. They're not going to go trade for Yu Darvish. But Quintana's a guy that you could see the Brewers going to trade for. They have the deep farm system. They can certainly take on the salary. So it's kind of a bit of a double whammy from the Cubs' perspective to sort of take him away from Milwaukee in the process of obviously adding him to their rotation.
It warms my heart that in July we're considering what top-level pitchers the Milwaukee Brewers could be thinking about acquiring. One of the most fun things of this whole season.
This is the StatCast podcast.
Right.
There are some interesting StatCast
I was going to get to that next.
Jose Quintana.
I was going to get to that next, and let's lead into that by actually looking at some of his traditional stats, which don't paint a very good picture right now. He has a 4.49 ERA. He has a career win-loss record of below 500. Now, we all know that win-loss record is totally irrelevant and it means nothing, but the 4.49 ERA, even though ERA is not exactly the best tool, it's still not something you can totally overlook. That's a lot of earned runs allowed, and there's some interesting things behind that. I mean, if you look at him over the years, his last couple years, he's been very consistent, right? 3.32 ERA, 3.36 ERA, 3.20 ERA. That's the kind of pitcher he is this year, a 4.49 ERA. However, his strikeout percentage is up by a lot. I feel, like I said, he's been consistent the last 3 years, his strikeout percentage about 21% every single year. This year, it's up to almost 25%, but he's actually kind of been swept up in the home run surge, and this is his issue that he's given up more home runs. But here's what's interesting about this. If you look at his expected weighted on base average, and that's a stat we use, it's based on the combination of exit velocity and launch angle to see how damaging a batted ball usually would be. And it's rolled into, along with strikeouts and walks, so you have a full picture. In 2015, his expected weighted on base was 307, and the league average, I think, is about 320. And last year, it was 293, so that's very, very good. And this year, it's 300, which is exactly in the middle of that. So if you just look at his quality of contact and the strikeouts and walks, because his walks are up along with the strikeouts, so they even out a little bit, he's basically been the same exact guy he's been. If you look at his hard hit percentage, which we count as 95-mile-an-hour exit velocity or higher, 2 years ago, 33%. Last year, 34%. This year, 34.8%. So up slightly, but not by that much. So you look at all that, and I see a guy who's basically been the exact same pitcher, more or less. So now you're asking, where's the 4.49 ERA coming from? And while I understand that there are limits to doing exactly what I'm about to do, I'm going to say it anyway. He had two disaster starts this year, back-to-back. May 24th, he gave up 8 earned runs to Arizona. May 30th, he gave up 7 earned runs to Boston. While you obviously can't ignore those and pretend they didn't happen, if you look at the rest of his starts, 3.54 ERA. His career is a 3.51 ERA. So I'm willing to say, based on this guy's long track record, that he had a pretty lousy week. Otherwise, he's been who he is.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly the prospect haul that they returned suggests that the Cubs are acknowledging that he's elite. You know, you don't give up, you know, your top two prospects for a pitcher that you don't think is still a he's like kind of a classic number two starter. Like, you know, like very durable and like sometimes elite, like occasionally elite.
That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Let's say the Cubs come back and take the division from the Brewers, which they very well still could, even though they're in a hole. Is he your number two starter? I think we agree Lester's probably number one. Do you start him over Arrieta? I don't know. I mean, maybe depending on how Arrieta's throwing at that point. I just think it's an interesting conversation to have because Arrieta is the more prototypical, like, I'm going to go out there and be the horse and throw it 95 miles an hour, while Quintana is a little more, I'm going to generate self-contact. I don't know. It's an interesting conversation.
Well, you know, certainly we'll cross that bridge. A lot of it so much depends on on you know, how they're pitching at the time and sort of what the who they're playing, you know, yada yada, what that right. lineup looks like. So right. That's sort of what's hard to tell.
But I like looking at you know, we look at these expected outcome stats, like what should have happened based on the kind of contact he's been allowing. So 183 starting pitchers this year have had at least 100 batters faced. So that's the sample we're working from. As I said, his expected weighted on base is 300. So that's 42nd of 183. So that's squarely in the top half. It's similar to Jake Arrieta. It's very similar to Yu Darvish. His expected batting average, which is the same thing. It just, you know, every hit is treated the same. 50th of 183, similar to Chris Archer. Similar to Yu Darvish. I mean, these are still pretty good names, and I think that actually kind of makes sense. I don't think of him as a top 10 starter, because he's not. But is he a top 30 starter in baseball-ish? Probably, as you said, a strong number two. I'll buy that. Yeah, that's pretty valuable, especially with his contract.
It's a fascinating trade for a variety of reasons, and like it's one that you could totally justify from both sides. I mean, now the White Sox, it's unclear if they're going to be good in the next couple years. But there's no question they're going to be a lot of fun.
I think they will. I mean, it's hard to say they're going to be good, right? But you saw, you know, what they got from the Red Sox for Chris Sale. Now what they've added here, they've got more trades to make, too. And what they got from the Nationals for Adam Eaton. I mean,
also signing Luis Robert.
Also that. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting team. And they got some young guys now, like Tim Anderson seems like he might be a keeper. The bullpen they have is pretty stellar. They're going to trade. They should trade someone like Tommy Conley or Swarzak for, like, an interesting second-tier prospect.
And also, Tim Anderson's the kind of guy, like, even if he's not good, he's fun because he's right. fast and he has some pop. Like, he's fun to watch. That's my point. It's sort of like, it's going to be an entertaining team no matter what. They'll still probably trade Todd Frazier. They could still trade, as you said, Conley, Swarzak. They might trade Jose Abreu. It's like...
Right. I think they are five games under or something like that right now. And I saw that our WhiteSox.com beat reporter Scott Merkin wrote, like, it's been a pretty okay season. And I saw he got a little bit heat about that because, you know, they're under 500. They're near to the bottom of the league. But for what their goals were this year, to rebuild for the future yet still put an entertaining product on the field, I have to say they've done a pretty good job. And so if you look at the guys they got back, so they got back Eloy Jimenez, who is an outfielder who was ranked, I believe, number 8 on MLB Pipeline's top 10.
In all of baseball. He's the Cubs' number one prospect.
And they got right-hander Dylan Cease and infielders Matt Rose and Bryant Flitt, which I probably didn't pronounce that right. Neither of those last two guys are on the top 30. I will say the one thing about this Bryant Flitt, who I just learned about like an hour ago, he's listed at 5'10 and 146 pounds, which makes me the closest to a big league baseball player I have ever been. I'm not a big leaguer, but a professional baseball player, because that's essentially what I am too. So I am now going to follow this guy. So we actually have some interesting numbers in some of these guys, but very first, a promo. We want to talk to you about our friends at the Cut 4 podcast. It's the podcast from the staff of our Cut 4 section, which focuses on the lighter side of baseball. If you've made it this far into our podcast, we think you'll enjoy it because it'll make you laugh and you might even learn something about baseball dogs or ballpark food. This week, Matt Monahan went to Miami, and he looked at the best-dressed major leaguer on the red carpet, the loudest applause during the All-Star game, and apparently grasshopper tacos, which are a thing. I don't know if you got a chance to sample those, but I'd love to hear your report if you did. So if you're into that, please search the Cut Forecast, C-U-T, number 4, C-A-S-T, in iTunes or wherever else, and do click subscribe. So you, Matt, were in attendance for the Futures game.
Or not? Wasn't.
Oh, you weren't there yet? Okay, unfortunately. But we watched the Futures game. It was on TV. And it's for me, it's annually like one of the most exciting events, not only because you get to see the guys on TV, but you get them in front of StatCast cameras. So there were a couple of interesting takeaways from this year. But first, I want to flash back to last year in San Diego, which I was at the Futures game for that. I remember sitting in the press box and watching this. And Eloy Jimenez, who is going to the White Sox, put on a little bit of a show last year in the Futures game. So, you know, right now he's only 20 years old. He's got a 351 on base, 490 slugging in A-ball. He's a legitimate future star. Last year he made this catch. He had to run 128 feet up against the short right field wall to make a catch. Now, it had almost 8 seconds worth of hang time. Certainly that matters. But at the time, if that had happened in the regular season game, it would have been one of the 5 longest distances by a right fielder to make a catch, which is cool. Like, he actually, you know, made it over there. But he also hit a home run 105.3 miles an hour. He hit a ground out 105.7 miles an hour and also doubled at 99.9 miles an hour. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
And last week, you might have seen it. We had a Cut 4 post on it. He, in batting practice in the minors, he hit one off the light stand. He pulled like a natural Roy Hobbs and smashed the...
And he did it later again, too. He did it twice. I think we have the video of the first one. It's fantastic. It's like right out of the movie. He is, as you said, the number 8 overall prospect in all of baseball from MLB Pipeline. And listen to this. This is what they wrote about him. He has a better chance to hit than Jorge Soler. Okay, fine. And drew some upside comparisons to Giancarlo Stanton in the Arizona Fall League. I mean, that is high praise. It's maybe a bit too high, but I mean, that's an interesting name to have attached to you.
The point is that this is like another just dynamic position player that the White Sox have added. So between him and Moncada, who they got in a trade, and you throw in Luis Robert, who they sign, and it's just like this is a potential just like wow.
Right.
Lineup.
And we haven't even talked about the fact that Avisaíl García has apparently learned how to hit after years of frustration. So as you say, the White Sox are very interesting. But moving on to this year's futures game, there's a bunch of guys who are, I think it's pretty easy to see in the big leagues in the next year or two, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the guys who stood out, who we knew would stand out, was Michael Kopech, who hit like, you know, threw like 101 in the game, but we knew he could. With pitchers, it's a little less exciting, the Statcast aspect, because like, we knew Michael Kopech. I mean, he's hit, right. I think, 105.
Yes, that was the report last year. But what was also interesting is if you looked at his spin rate, and I don't have the number in front of me, but his average spin rate for like the six fastballs or whatever he threw would have been the second highest spin rate in baseball this year on a four-seam fastball, which I find interesting because even though we know velocity and spin, it's correlated for a single pitcher, we've spent so much time talking about how Lucas Giolito does not have that spin rate. So I find that interesting. Like, you know, these two guys who are very highly touted, both acquired in trades for the White Sox, may have different futures. And I'm not saying that Giolito can't be good. I still think he can be good, but he might just not have like the wipeout, I'm going to blow you away and get swinging strikes fastball that is correlated with high spin.
Yeah, but anyway, other guys in this year's futures game, the one guy that really stood out to me was the Braves outfield prospect, Ronald Acuna.
But he went 0-for-4, so he didn't have a good game.
the best part, he had the only barrel of the game, you know, barrels being the sort of optimal, the Statcast definition of the optimal batted ball contact, starting at, I guess, 98 degrees?
98 miles per hour, not the boy band, yeah. 98 degrees. 98 miles per hour between 26 and 30, and as you hit it harder, the band of launch angle gets wider. It's really about how can you find that success with a minimum average of 500 and slugging 1,500, but the average is really more like 800 and 3,000.
Well, anyway, it was the only barrel of the game. Unfortunately, he hit it right at the center
right
fielder,
Corey Ray.
Brewers prospect, Corey Ray, but it was the only barrel. It was hit at 112.3 miles per hour, which was not only the hardest hit ball of the game, my favorite stat of the futures game, it was harder hit than any ball an Atlanta Braves player has had this year, which isn't even an insult. Like, the Braves have Matt Kemp, he hits the ball hard. Freddie Freeman hits the ball hard. Tyler Flowers...
been crushing the ball.
Hits the ball, like, exit velocity, he hits the ball really hard. 112 is, speaking of other, you know, R&B bands...
Oh, I enjoyed that. I believe it's in the top 1% of Major League Baseball batted balls. The point is, that's a skill. You can't fake it, right? Like, I could not fake... most Major Leaguers could not fake throwing a ball 100 miles an hour like Chapman can. If you can't even do it once. And I think this is kind of the same thing. You have to have this skill. And at 19 or 20 or whatever he is, that's a legit skill. That's extremely impressive.
In addition to that, he had the three hardest outfield throws of the day, hitting 92.9, 95.2, and 96.7. So this is, you look at this kind of guy and like, you see five tools thrown around, and this is the kind of guy that like, this guy legitimately has the five-tool package.
I really look forward to the 2020 Braves-White Sox World Series because the Braves have a lot of guys like this. MLB Pipeline, again, not only called him a five-tool talent, but said evaluators get downright giddy when discussing Acuna,
who was just promoted to AAA after the futures game. I think I had his season line down here,
but
I don't have it. It's
so
good.
It's probably still too soon to see him this year, but it's not unreasonable to see him next year. And that's kind of the point of the futures game. We've seen guys like Aaron Judge in the futures game. We've seen Trey Turner in recent futures games. These guys get there pretty quickly once you get to that point.
Gary Sanchez was in the futures game last year, and then almost won, and still almost won AL Rookie.
That's right. That's exactly right. Another guy who stood out is someone who's actually already seen some big league time. Derek Fisher, outfield prospect for the Houston Astros, was up, I think, had five games earlier and hit two home runs for the Astros and went back down. He actually scored the first run of the game, and this was on one of those plays where Acuna tried to throw him out and didn't quite get there. So he came around from second base to score the first run of the game on a single, and he got to a sprint speed of 29.6 feet per second. And so we've been talking about sprint speed a lot, but it measures a runner's speed in feet per second in their fastest 1 second window, so it's their top speed. The MLB average is 27. The elite guys like Hamilton and Buxton, their averages get up to about 30. The slowest guys, catchers, DH, is about 23. So 29.6, and that's legit. That's another thing you can't fake. Like, the slow runners cannot fake that. That's a legit skill. And, you know, Fisher is a guy we already saw crush the ball. He's mashing the ball, too, and he can run.
Yeah, he's a really unique. It's a unique profile. He's having a fantastic season in the minors. He could be trade bait if the Astros decide they really want to. If they end up going out to trade for a Sonny Gray, which is a big rumor, I think he would front that package. I don't think they'd give up Kyle Tucker, but I think they would give up Fisher. But we've talked about recently about Bradley Zimmer, and I sort of compare Fisher a little bit to him in the sense that, like, it's rare to see guys drafted out of college with sort of like a dynamic position players with like the speed power, like multi-dimensional combo, which is the players with those skill sets usually end up getting drafted out of high school. So to see another guy, both of them sort of fit this similar profile, being like surprisingly fast with some pop, like both first round picks. Fisher actually had come into his junior year being discussed as like a top five, maybe the number one overall pick when he was at Virginia, but I think it was a hand injury and just had kind of a mediocre junior year, ended up falling to like the end of the first round or supplemental first round. But now you're seeing the kind of talent that he is. Of course, the base stealing is not, the speed is not necessarily manifested itself in base stealing. 2015, he was 31 for 38. Okay, that's good. Last year, 28 for 35. Also good. This year, 14 for 24.
Not so good.
Less good.
Not so good. Well, as you can tell, Matt and I both very much enjoy the Futures game because you get to see these guys and put some numbers to them. You know, tomorrow's stars are here today, basically, literally. But I do kind of want to move on and talk about a guy who had become one of the probably five biggest young superstars in baseball and struggled through a pretty disappointing first half, and that's Manny Machado. Manny Machado's on-base percentage is below 300 right now. His on-base and his slugging are almost to the second decimal point exactly what they were when he was a 19-year-old rookie in 2012. This is a guy who, over the last 2 years, totally blossomed. He was up there in the conversations with Trout, with Harper, with Stanton. I mean, he was the guy. And this year, it hasn't really worked out so much.
I mean, there were legitimate conversations recently of when he and Harper are free agents at the same time, who's going to get more? A year ago, if you asked that question, you could, you know, when Harper was kind of scuffling and Machado was having a career year, you could sort of say, oh, that's actually a debate that's worth having. Maybe not so much right now, but the point is, like, Machado is still pretty young.
He's 24, I think.
Yeah, and still, I still consider him one of the 10 best players in the game, despite his...
But I agree. And when, you know, everybody talks about Nolan Arenado, like, oh, he's by far the best defensive third baseman in baseball. And it's like, yeah, I'll buy he's the best, but can we not forget that Machado exists and is also extremely good? It's pretty close. And people seem to forget about Machado, I think, because he's not hitting, which is sort of what's plagued, like, the Gold Gloves for years.
But is he really not hitting?
Wow, that's a very interesting question and a very professional segue into our question here. So the surface stats say no, he's not hitting, right? Poor batting average, poor on-base percentage, poor slugging. But I always like to look at the underlying skills here, and this is a piece I just wrote today. Who's going to be likely to bounce back from a hitting perspective in the second half? And I got to say Manny Machado. We have defined 95 miles an hour as our hard hit baseline of exit velocity, right? That's really where a ball turns from a batted ball into a hard hit batted ball. Manny Machado has hit the most batted balls at 95 miles an hour or more of anybody. He's done it 128 times. So that says to me a couple things. It says to me, well, he's not hurt. The swing speed is still there. He's still capable of squaring up the baseball. He's not getting fooled by pitches. He's striking out a little bit more, which is true, but he's still hitting balls extremely hard. And the production just hasn't been there. So that's something that I like to look at a lot. Like, you know, in May, I wrote about how Jackie Bradley was struggling pretty badly, but he was hitting the ball extremely well. And ever since then, Bradley's been crushing. So they don't always all work out that well, but that one did. I'm on board with Machado doing better in the second half. By the way, he had 3 home runs in the last week before the All-Star break.
Exactly. I was just about to say, he had a 2-homer game over the weekend. I'm buying the bounce back. And one thing that's interesting, because I also think the Orioles should be looking to shop him aggressively. I'll get to that in a second, but I want to make one other point about the hard hit leader. So the hard hit leaderboard, 95 miles per hour plus. We've got Machado number one, Cano, Yelich, and Jose Abreu tied for second at 124. We've got Carlos Correa at number five. And then number six fascinates me, Mookie Betts.
Matt's about to drop some math education on
you
here.
The reason why Mookie Betts fascinates me is because he is a perfect example of why average exit velocity is not a great way of looking at a player from a StatCast perspective. We often get questions of who are the leaders in average exit velocity, and it's not meaningless. I'm not suggesting it's meaningless.
Right, it's still Judge at the top of that too.
Yeah, it's guys, you know, it's Nelson Cruz, it's guys hit the ball hard. The problem is that, as we've said before, a batted ball at 90 miles an hour and 80 miles an hour and 70 miles per hour are almost all the same. Like, the production is, you're not going to get a wide range of production. However, once you get past 95 and 100, 105, you see huge jumps in production. And Mookie Betts is a perfect example. He's never going to hit the ball 110 miles an hour, but he is more often than pretty much any, I mean, as often as anyone else, hitting that ball in that, like, 95 to 105 zone. So he does it with such regularity that that's far more important than his average exit velocity. His average exit velocity, the guys who have put the ball in play 100 times this year, ranks
99th.
Tied with Cole Calhoun.
So he's a good example of consistency in that small window. Because you're right, he's not going to have those extreme 117-mile-an-hour batted balls. But if he's up there pretty consistently hitting it, you know, 94, 95, 97, 98, and maybe fewer of those 60, 65. Because you're right, at a certain point, if you hit it poorly, does it matter if it's 40 or 65? It doesn't. But it certainly will drag down your average, depending on which one of those is. And so that's less of a StatCast thing, I guess, than just a math thing. Like, average can be flawed in a great deal of ways.
But anyway, going back to Machado for a second, if I'm the Orioles, I think the Orioles should be looking to rebuild and fast.
There was a report right before we came on that they are talking to the Dodgers about Zach Britton, which I think would be a fantastic fit for both sides. I mean, the Dodgers have pieces. They certainly could slot Britton in front of Kenley Jansen and make, like, the best 8-9 in Major League history, essentially.
Yeah, that's the thing. And even as a team as good as the Dodgers, every team could always use more relief pitching. And Britton's not a rental. He's under control through next year, so it'll be a year and a half thing, as is Machado. And there are enough contenders out there with needs at third base, or shortstop, mind you, because the fact that Manny Machado has never played shortstop regularly in the majors still kind of bothers me, because I still kind of think he should be a shortstop.
I'm coming around on it. At first I didn't, because he'd hurt his knees twice, and I thought, okay, maybe. But when he has had to fill in there, he's looked fine.
But what's interesting is that in context of this Cubs-White Sox trade, because, you know, it was like the controversy of them trading within the same city. Granted, they don't play in the same division. But along the same lines, you often hear, well, don't trade in the same division. Because it just so happens that probably the best two fits for Machado are in the same division, where the Yankees and Red Sox have been getting nothing from third base.
I want you to explain, and then I'm going to explain why I fully agree with you on one of those and fully disagree with you on the other one. But go ahead.
So the Red Sox third base production in terms of weighted runs created plus, 29th in MLB at third base, Yankees 24th. And the reason why these teams in a vacuum are great fits is because they have the need, and they also are the kinds of teams, you know, when Machado's a free agent, both these teams are going to be bidding for him anyway. So they're both the kind of teams that are positioned, assuming that are positioned if a trade went well, to bring him back, to extend him. And we're seeing that more and more often, where teams trade for guys and extend them.
And they may be the only two contenders seriously in the market for a third baseman, right? Because third base is pretty deep. You know, you got your Turners, your Arenados, your Bryants. There's a lot of teams that just don't need a third baseman. And so they might be I can't really think of another one off the top of my head that would seriously need a third baseman.
Yeah, there's one team that could use a shortstop that I don't really think would trade for Machado, but I would be excited to see it. And that's the Minnesota Twins.
unlikely, but sure.
They're not a team I would see potentially re-signing Machado, so they'd be less likely to want to give up the prospects it would take to get him. The Yankees interest me because also they have Gregorius, who they have, you know, under control for a little while at shortstop, and they also have Gleyber Torres, who just had Tommy John surgery, who's a good prospect. His value might be a little low, but like he'd be a fascinating piece because the Yankees, considering the circumstances, are probably willing to trade him in the short term in a way that maybe they weren't 2 months ago.
Yeah, and remember, Tommy John surgeries for position players aren't really as serious. It's serious, but he's expected to be 100% next spring.
Yes.
So it's not going to cost him a whole year of season or anything like that.
I mean, again, it's probably not going to happen. AL East teams, it's, you know, the history of that division, but I do think the Orioles are in a spot where they're sort of in a position similar to the Reds, I got to say, where they're probably a long way away from being an elite team. They've had really struggled to develop pitching, and like the fact that Gausman's a guy, like, He's been expecting to become good for about 3 years now. I'm finally giving up on him.
Big step back this year. He looked pretty good last year. I've been out on Bundy for a long time.
I think he's just going to be a guy.
Yeah.
Injury is obviously a factor there, but they have two great pieces right now who are under control until through 2018 that they could really jumpstart a rebuild if they dealt them. And they probably could still get good packages for them this offseason, so I can understand why they want to hold on to them, but if I were them, I'd really be aggressively looking to see what's out there for those two guys right now.
So there's a couple things here I agree with you on. I agree with you fully. The Orioles should be looking to move some of these big pieces. Because a guy like Britton, yeah, you don't want to wait till the offseason because then you lose the allure of a postseason. And we can make all our jokes about him not pitching in the wildcard game we want. He would be extremely valuable. And you saw what guys like Miller and what guys like Chapman brought back last year. So I think right away that would be huge. I don't see them actually trading Machado right now until he actually starts hitting better. I agree with you that they should explore it, but I don't see it happening. If they did, the Yankees are a phenomenal fit. I completely agree with that. Here's the thing about the Red Sox. That whole ridiculous beanball war, like from early in the season, you know, putting him in the clubhouse there, it seems unlikely to me. I think that's stupid, I'm just saying, like, that's kind of the real world factor here.
I guess, but if, let's just say, argument's sake, that what happened last weekend is a sign of Machado goes crazy for 2 weeks. If on July 30th he's on the stretch where he's hit, you know, 7 home runs in 2 weeks, hitting four, you know, showing if he's being the Manny Machado of old, I think that he could easily, in a 2 week stretch, change the conversation about him as a trade piece.
I do enjoy the idea of the Yankees and Red Sox competing to see which one gets Machado and which one gets Todd Frazier. Right? Because he's the other, now that Moustakas is probably not going to be dealt, Frazier, I think, is the other main third base option out there. And these two teams have got to do something. Like, they have to. So I think that would be interesting. Well, I agree with you. I still think Machado is going to be in Baltimore. Let's finish up by moving on to our Hall of Fame. Every week we induct a very interesting Statcast play from the previous week into the Hall of Fame. Now, as you may have noticed, there haven't been very many games over the last week because it's the All-Star break. And even though we've been trying our hardest not to just induct Aaron Judge home runs every week, when somebody hits a 513-foot home run, even if it's in glorified batting practice in the Home Run Derby, he's going to be the man, right? I assume you all saw the Home Run Derby, and I got to say, he more than lived up to expectations. I mean, he hit 47 home runs, a total distance of nearly 4 miles by himself. He hit a couple over 500, and he hit one.
He hit four over 500, including two in a row at one point.
Including two in a row. He hit one, 118 miles an hour, 35 degrees, which is essentially perfect, 513 feet. Now, the longest home run in the 3 years of Statcast that we have tracked in actual gameplay is Giancarlo Stanton, 504 feet at Coors Field, by the way, which is like the perfect mixture of player and location. The next two longest are 495 by Judge himself earlier this year, and Chris Bryant in what I believe was a pretty strong Wrigley Field wind a couple years ago. So, I mean, that is really interesting. And in addition to just saying, "Wow, 513 feet is pretty cool," it sort of raises the question: how far can a human being hit a baseball in these conditions? Because there are all these like these stories from like years ago where Mickey Mantle hit 565 and somebody like in the Negro League hit one 700 feet. And I suppose if there's like a hurricane force wind behind you with like 60 miles of wind at your back, some of that's possible, sure. But I have a really, really difficult time even like going back to the greats of our sport, Mantle, Ruth, Garrick, whoever, that any of those men were just as physically strong as Aaron Judge is right now. I can't see it possibly happening.
Carlos Peguero.
So here's a name I did not expect we'd be talking about today. Carlos Peguero, who was a Mariners prospect, I believe, for a while, the Red Sox for a little bit, never made enough contact. Like, he reminds me of William Opeña in a lot of ways. But to get to his huge power. So he's actually playing in Japan right now. And some of the ballparks, not all, but some of them in Japan actually have TrackMan set up. And he hit one that was measured at, wait for it, 513 feet over the weekend, and we watched the video. And my God, does that hold up? I mean, that passes the eye test.
I would say, if I could have seen it, maybe I'd like, the whole crowd is just like, where did it go?
It goes like 40 rows deep out in right field.
The camera doesn't know what to do. It's just like flailing all over the place.
But what I found interesting is, so Aaron Judge hit his 513 in Miami with the roof closed, and so did Peguero. It was in a dome. So these are kind of like environment neutral home runs, which is cool because, you know, you always got to account for elevation, let's say Colorado or humidity or the wind. But these two guys hit at 513 in essentially neutral environments. And I think the ball in Japan is slightly different than the major league ball. So, you know, take that into effect. But I don't know if you forget like wind and elevation and everything, 5 25-ish? Does that, that's got to be where guys can top out? I mean,
it certainly has to be. We're seeing it right now. I mean, Aaron Judge in a batting practice environment tops out at 513. We've seen in a game environment him and Stanton basically top out around 500.
Yeah.
So
the one thing that was pointed out to me was, so, you know, he hit this, Judge did, you know, off of a batting practice fastball. So let's call it 65 miles an hour. Now, if you hit one off of a ball that was thrown, let's say, at 100 miles an hour, that will go out further. Because while the myth of hard in, hard out is not as strong as people like to think it was, it's not nothing. You know, the physics has shown that the batter is responsible for 82% of exit velocity. So the pitch is 18%. 18% isn't nothing, but it's also a lot harder to square up. I mean, that's
so,
the hard
so
part.
What I want to see now is, what I want to see is Judge in the box against the best command. Who's the best command pitcher in baseball right now?
The best command pitcher?
Who has the best command in baseball right now?
I don't know. Chris Sale. I don't know. You put me on the spot.
Someone who's like just throws, can throw a dead
but
straight.
Basically, what you want is a batting practice version where he knows it's not going to be a breaking pitch. It's going to be 100 miles an hour.
I'd say 90 miles an hour.
But something he knows it's coming, so it's easy for him to time up.
If a
right?
pitcher to say to him, I'm going to throw a 90 mile an hour fastball right down the heart of the plate, and just get, or just do a pitching machine
right
feeding him at 90 miles an hour right down the heart.
And then we can really do the test.
That's the real test.
That would be
test.
Interesting. How do we make that happen?
Oh, we'll get back to it.
Well, now that's something to think about, because we need that in a controlled environment. And then after we do that in a neutral environment, then I want that to happen at Coors Field. We've got all sorts of ideas. We just have to get them on the field. That's our show for this week. This is the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm Mike Petriello. He's Matt Myers. We will catch you next week. Thanks very much for listening.